housing, NHS dentistry, government handling of COVID, and the Dr. Ranson appeal, cheaper internet services, and greater fiscal responsibility were just a few of the items discussed in Tynwald this week. Loads to fit in on this week's perspective. First up, David Ashford, who was successful in bringing forward two motions.
They were both amended, but amended in the general direction that you'd hoped for. So if we start with the motions, the first was in relation to ministerial decisions being formally recorded on a register. I suppose many people listening would probably be thinking, well, if it's a big decision, is it not already being recorded somewhere?
Well, not necessarily is the answer to that. Different departments seem to treat ministerial decisions in different ways. In fact, even what actually classes as a ministerial decision. I put a question in, which probably made me very highly unpopular in some quarters last year, asking for copies of all the ministerial decisions for the previous 18 months. And the reason I did that was to actually draw out and show that this is, at the moment, a very convoluted system, very much at the behest of the individual departments. And at a time when we keep hearing this mantra of joined up government moving in one direction, being one force, the actual decision-making process is anything but. And it's very important, I think, that you'll never remove the total risk, but you minimise the risk of one department going off in one direction, spending public money, and another department going off in a completely different direction. And I laid out in the court an example from when I was Minister for Health that we courted early, but we could have had the Department for Education, the Department for Health going off in two different directions if the ministers hadn't spoken to one another.
And I suppose that's the point, isn't it? Do ministers not speak to each other? Surely if these things are important enough to be concerned about potential conflict, ministers would be telling each other about them anyway.
Well, without going into too much detail of what the issue was, it wasn't something that would be absolutely massive as a government policy decision. And it was simply the fact that we had shared a department member that this came to light. If you had ministerial decisions coming into the centre and also actually going even for noting to council and ministers, yes, the decision's already been made, but at least you catch it early and another minister may say, well, hang on, you've just agreed this, but I've agreed something similar in my department where there's overlap that's completely different. And you can actually catch it early and get the correction in before you spend public money. Because I do really I'm concerned that at some point in the future, it hasn't happened yet, but there could be a catastrophe where you have two departments going off in a different direction. And until something goes seriously wrong, you will not actually realise that that's been happening.
And we have had the ministerial system for over three decades now, and nothing appears to have gone wrong, and we haven't had that register.
We haven't, but, well, nothing we know of has gone wrong. Phil, to be perfectly honest, there's not necessarily the case that nothing's gone wrong, nothing catastrophic that we know of. But equally, like I say, I mean, I've always supported of single legal entity. I mean, that has a bit of a bad name now with connotations about where certain way other jurisdictions have done it. So I like to call it a one government approach. But I've always firmly believed, you know, we shouldn't have this silo mentality of departments. Government should be working as one entity. And part of that has to surely come down to good governance and the decision-making process. It's not even properly defined what is a ministerial decision. We need to get down to drill down what that is as well. And also, ministerial decisions are FOIable. So there is the ability for people to put FOIs in around ministerial decisions. So having the log could actually save work in the long term.
And I rather flippantly introduced Tynwald by suggesting that ministers make many, many decisions during the day, including whether they wanted a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. So where would you put that definition? Because there are things like deciding that I'm going to meet such and such a person on such and such a day, or we're going to have a meeting of whatever committee on another particular day. Those decisions are taken by ministers, but those presumably are not the kind of things that you would want So perhaps if you tell me what you would think should be in there in terms of a definition.
So from my point of view, it's the things that are signed on what's termed the MINDEC, Ministerial Decision Forms, that come forward. So you most certainly don't want to know a minister's diary inside and out and whether they've had the cup of tea or not. But also, even for those that are signed on a Ministerial Decision Form, it's the things that are within the behest of the department, that may be new policy, maybe expenditure of public money. Some of the things you might even exclude, which I mentioned in the chamber there, is, for instance, if you look at Treasury, a lot of the ministerial decisions are around sanctions, sanctioning individuals, doing things that keep us compliant, for instance, with money val and so on. You wouldn't even necessarily want to class them as ministerial decisions, because they are a result of a very public decision that we are going to comply with international law, we are going to comply with the requirements put on us by international bodies. So you wouldn't even necessarily include those, because they're a result of something else. So for me, but it's very much for me around the signed ministerial decisions.
And presumably, I mean, there are decisions taken in DEFA. The DEFA minister makes decisions on planning appeals. The DOI minister makes various decisions on highways-related matters. Are all of those decisions to be included, these sort of semi-judiciary roles, or is it just the major sort of policy decisions?
Well, the crucial thing with the semi-judicial roles is that the quasi-judicial roles that ministers hold, such as planning, they're public. So they're already out there. So, for instance, if the DEFA minister makes a judgment on an appeal or decides not to go with an inspector's report, that is already published. So that's already out there. So that's something that already has due governance and scrutiny around it. So that's in slightly different to an actual ministerial decision. Like I say, from my point of view, it's the things with the form, or what's termed MINDEC form. Because, as I pointed out in there, I'm not saying this has happened for a long number of years, but ministers can operate departments in different ways. If a minister wanted to, they could run their department by ministerial decision. They don't have to involve their other department members. I think it would be a very crazy minister that didn't, but they don't have to get things through the department board. They could purely sit there signing ministerial decisions. Now, like I say, I'm not aware of that having happened for many, many years, but in theory, it could, because it's down to the individual minister. And I think we need to have proper governance. And I was delighted the Chief Minister recognised that. And it will be considered something brought back to Timwell before October.
And another of your motions, of course, was the Dormant Assets Fund. And you're keen to allow the Manx Lottery Trust to spend bigger amounts of money.
Well, it's not so much the Lottery Trust spending bigger amounts of money as allocating it to the charities to be able to spend, and organisations to be able to spend bigger amounts of money. 50,000 limit was put in a good number of years ago. Now, I constantly speak in Timwood about various things where I don't think it's right we write limits into things. I think we should always have some measure of it automatically increasing. And I think now is a good point for a review. Again, I thank the Treasury Minister for bringing forward the amendment that he did, which gives me what I was hoping for anyway. And I hope that the Dormant Assets Fund will be able to be used to support more organisations on Ireland. The monies that have gone out of it so far have proved very crucial to those organisations that have received it, but I've spoken to a number of charities where there has been frustrations around that 50,000 limit, because as several members said during the debate on the motion, what you got 50,000 a few years ago isn't what you get for 50,000 now. So I'm glad there's a recognition that that does need to be reviewed. And I do want to put on record, because I made very, very clear with the motion, this wasn't a slight on the Manx Lottery Trust in any way, shape or form. The work that they do in supporting organisations, individuals and also charities is been absolutely phenomenal over the last few years, some of the projects they've been able to support, and I hope that by widening it out they'll be able to support some bigger projects and actually be able to benefit the community more.
Do you think that other non-ministerial Timwell members could learn from the David Ashford playbook of asking for slightly more than you expect Council of Ministers to give you, and then being completely happy that they amend it back probably to something closer to what you expected you'd get anyway.
Well, I hate to disappoint you, Phil, but there's no playbook in play. My emotions that come forward are what I believe should happen. I'm a pragmatic politician, though. I recognise the fact that, you know, you can fight for what you want, but if there's a compromise that comes along and the compromise still gives you the majority of what you want, then if that's the compromise that Tim Ward's going to go for, then that's fine. I don't take issue with that. But my emotions are always what I believe should happen. There will be people, as you know, in Tim Ward from your time, you know, there's people that agree with you, there's people who don't. We have a debate and then Tim Ward decides. But for me, it's always about me standing for what I believe in, pushing it forward. And if Tim Ward doesn't agree with me, that's fine. At least I've publicly said and pushed for what I believe is right. Others may hold a different view.
There were a couple of heated debates in Tynwald. The one in relation to government's handling of the appeal relating to Dr. Ranson's case, and another in terms of the report into government's handling of COVID. You had some things to say, and I think you were getting a little irritated by some of the comments of some of the members.
Well, I think what's important, I mean, we had some, I think it was a very good Tynwald debate, actually, on both the Brunner report and the Wright report. It's coming back again. This was only the initial phase. There'll be further debates in July. But my remarks, I tended to keep it to what the situation was at the time, because we are now 4 years on from that first lockdown. And it's very easy to forget what the situation was. So when we talk about things like personal protective equipment, it's very important to remember the demand there was around the world at that time that you couldn't do like you could do now or prior to COVID, just go out and say, I'll have some FFP3 masks, please, off a supplier, and you got them. There was minimum ordering quantities, trying to source them. I mean, one of the things, and again, I thank all the teams who were involved in the procurement at the time, that we did very successfully as an island, is we did not run out of PPE. It was a struggle to get it, and there were teams going around, you know, looking around the world to source us PPE. We had it coming from as far afield as China and the, you know, the Middle East and all sorts. But people, it's easy to forget that now and to slip back into thinking you could do what you just did now. And so I focus my remarks mainly on reminding people of what the situation was at the time. And the fact we hadn't faced something like this since the Spanish flu pandemic after the First World War. And that was mainly spread by troops returning from the front. Now you can get on a plane and you can be most places in not more than 24 hours around the world. There's nothing really out of reach. And that causes serious problems for a pandemic. And the other thing I wanted to focus on was, I think it's very important government doesn't end up in the trap of thinking the next pandemic will be the same as COVID. It could be very, very different. We could be faced with completely different circumstances. So anything we put in place and any learning from COVID has to be adaptable to the situation that we find ourselves in.
And that is, again, that's part of the problem here. I mean, the one of the issues that you have as a government, members of Council of Ministers will have a list of priorities, maybe 100 priorities and enough budget to fund 80 of them. Things like pandemic planning, I know, have occurred from time to time across government, because certainly even when I was still in government, we had these planning exercises. But it's very hard, isn't it, to, first of all, ensure that sufficient funding is put into these areas when a pandemic hasn't occurred maybe for several decades, so it's not seen as the absolute priority. And also, as you sort of allude to there, it's difficult to predict what kind of pandemic it is that you're planning for.
I mean, the simple fact is it's impossible. You cannot, unless you've got a crystal ball and very good foresight, be able to predict exactly what you're going to be facing. And that's why, like I say, it needs to be adaptable. You know, I mean, pandemic is quite interesting in the fact that, like I say, I referred to, we hadn't seen anything really like it since the Spanish flu. But if you look at the UK's risk rate, register, the likelihood of another pandemic, say, in the next 5 years is between a 5 to 25% risk margin in that risk register. So, you know, as the world becomes a smaller place with the way we travel, the way we all intermingle now, then that risk obviously increases because things can spread faster and can develop faster. So I think what is important that any planning does the best it can. I mean, I've always been a firm believer that any plan is only as good as till the moment it touches reality, and then you find where the flaws very quickly are in it. But I think it's something that we shouldn't knock down the priority list by thinking, oh well, it was 100 years really since this, between the Spanish flu and COVID, we've got another 100 years to prepare. We might not have. We may have, but we might not. And it is important it doesn't fall off the radar, because I was quite honest with the COVID inquiry. We did have pandemic plans, which you've referred to. Some of it was very useful, but some of it, to be honest, I found wasn't worth the paper it was written on, because it didn't bear, a resemblance to the reality that was facing us. And so I think it is difficult, but we've got to make sure we use COVID as an opportunity to make sure that the good things we built during then, such as, for instance, the chart team, which was able to help support social care and other areas, that is there ready to go should we have another situation like this.
Do you think the current Tenwald, the current Council of Ministers, are operating as the kind of slick unit that is required to actually cope with another big emergency like COVID?
Well, I'm outside of Council of Ministers at the moment, so I can only give an outsider's view. I do worry in politics sometimes that personalities do get in the way, in the fact that things boil down to people arguing amongst themselves. I would hope, though, and I think that in a case of a public emergency, that everyone would pull together as they did over COVID. I think, you know, government as a unit worked together and actually delivered things at very, very short notice. We showed during COVID that if government wishes to get something done and really wishes to push for it, it can be done. And I think there's lessons there to be brought into day-to-day politics as well. But we did work as a team, I think, and I would hope that team working would carry on, because at the end of the day, we're not elected for ourselves, we're elected by the people to represent them, and we're there to represent their views and also, you know, do the best for our island. And I would hope that everyone's doing that. I believe everyone that's in that chamber, I'll be absolutely clear, is there for the right reasons. I believe that every one of them wants to do good for the Isle of Man. And I believe that if an emergency came up, we would work together to actually get that best result.
And finally, the Chief Minister was very forthright in giving apologies to various people involved, people who'd lost loved ones, people who'd been affected by the quite stringent controls that were put in place. Is there anything in the reports, or indeed anything that you feel that you should be apologising for in relation to the handling of COVID?
Well, I think, we've done long interviews on this, and I have had a lot of time to reflect on it. I think in terms of the actual way COVID went in the end, I think we actually did do well. I think one of the problems, though, was that the overarching system that was running it, so for instance, the command structure didn't work in the way that it should have done. I think in terms of obviously what happened in Abbotswood, I think was an absolute national tragedy. And I think, you know, certainly, like I say, the way that criminal investigation went on was not something I particularly would have wanted. I didn't support, for instance, the exclusion of residents, which has now come out because we've had freedom of information requests around council administered minutes and so on. I didn't support the exclusion of residents from the island. I actually moved that we have border controls but allow residents back in. And I think, you know, we should never, as I said yesterday, have let that happen. We should never exclude residents again from their own homeland.
Housing Minister Tim Crookle answered a couple of questions. First, on housing waiting lists.
There are something in the region of, 40,000-ish, maybe a few more, thousand households on the island. 900 householders are looking for public sector housing. It seems quite a large proportion.
It does when you say it that way, but as we were just discussing, it may well be that people, as I say, either looking for local authority housing or hedging their bets, just, you know, putting their names on the list, waiting for the future in case they can't or circumstances change. But that list is a big list, and we, you know, we're all well aware of that, and we're trying to do something about that, working with the local authorities.
Because, of course, there is a huge difference between a public sector house, the rental that you would pay in a public sector house, and the rental that you would pay for a private sector rental.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, there have been schemes that have been tried and tested, and some have worked, some haven't in the past, mid-rent and things like that, to try and help people. But we and the local authorities, I think, try our best, you know, to accommodate people as and when we can. And if all the local authorities and ourselves, you know, we've got one or two empty houses as well at the moment that need doing up and getting back into the market, if you like. You know, we need to get those houses put back into circulation as quickly as possible.
The answer that you gave was specifically in relation to waiting lists. And the positive news is that at least the waiting list numbers are going in the right direction.
Yeah, it's 18 that it's come down. I mean, it's negligible really over that period of time. I think it was 2.5 years or something like that. It is negligible. But, you know, if more and more people, as we were just saying, maybe as a safeguard to put the names on the list. I don't know the reason for the list, you know, being that big, but it is big when you say it's 900 plus.
And in terms of the answer to this, well, obviously you need to build more houses. There's a lot of work going on with local authorities at the moment in terms of upgrading houses, but it tends to be upgrades as opposed to effectively renewing housing rather than new houses.
Yeah, and over the years there's been a lot of upgrades and stuff, and there's been a lot of new houses built, but actually there's been a lot of old ones taken out of circulation as well. And I think at the last time I was questioned on this, I think it was actually only 9 new houses, or extra new houses, if you like, which doesn't go anywhere at all to helping solve this situation. But there are plans going forward, and obviously we're working on that with local authorities who want to build new. And they all have to go through the planning, of course.
One of the other aspects of housing, really, is the landlords. And, of course, there is landlord legislation, landlord registration, Private Housing Act 2021. And Mr. Mercer was quite keen to know what progress was being made with that.
Yeah, and as I said, yeah, I'm totally open and honest with this. It's a little over the last few months because there's so much else going on within the department, and we have got a lack of officers in the right area doing this work. So, you know, they're fully stretched on, you know, on what we're asking them to do at the time. So this hasn't had that much attention, but it will do, you know, as we move forward. This will get the attention it needs. And as I said, I'll come back to Tynwald as soon as possible with a date as to when I hope to bring it back to members.
Mr. Mercer's concerns seem to be more for the landlords that potentially are nervous or uncertain as to what's going to happen. But of course, it's not just landlords that are going to be impacted by this. If landlords feel so uncertain that they choose to stop renting out their properties, then, you know, this exacerbates the housing problems that we're facing.
Yeah, it is the uncertainty for everybody involved, whether it's landlords, whether it's people looking after those, you know, estate agents looking after those properties on behalf of other people, and obviously the people that want to be in those properties. So, you know, we need to get this sorted and move it on as quickly as possible, which I've endeavoured, you know, we will try and do.
Russian MHK Michelle Hayward had a motion on Gaza.
Were you surprised that with government, the Chief Minister in particular, having kind of dragged their feet on making any statement in relation to particularly Israel's actions in Gaza, that this pretty much sailed through Tynwald?
Yeah, it was. I mean, we started discussing, you know, the sort of backbenchers were discussing this in January. Yeah. We were discussing it before Christmas, actually, and then, you know, come back in January. And I think we were waiting for government to take the lead on this. They spoke very early when Russia went into Ukraine, and we had a debate on that. So we do speak on international matters, and we seem to have, yeah, as you say, dragged our feet a little bit over this one. So I was, you know, in the end, to get to the point where we'll put a motion down and we'll force the issue. And you're right, if it was unanimously carried, even in a slightly amended version, actually, perhaps we could have said that sooner.
Because the Chief Minister did condemn the Hamas attacks, didn't he?
Yes, he condemned the Hamas attacks at the time, and that was a fairly rapid response. And then we seem to have sat back and decided not to comment about further escalations that happened.
So having now succeeded in getting this motion through, am I right in thinking that the motion also formally recognises the state of Palestine.
The motion does recognise that Palestine has a right, and the citizens of Palestine have rights, on the international stage. I'm not sure that that's happened before in Timor's history, but nobody's actually commented today anything other to the contrary.
In terms of the debate, there was very little by way of opposition. One slight certainly a negative vote was in relation to the amendment, and that was from Paul Crane. Paul Crane, I think, was taking the view that maybe the original motion would have been better than the amended one. The amended one watered down slightly what your original intention was. I presume, though, that you are content that even in the slightly watered down version, it's still a good and strong statement from Tynwald.
I am. I think it was more important that Tynwald spoke as one voice than that we spent time, we spent weeks trying to formulate the right motion and the right words. It's very careful, particularly in this context, to choose your words very, very carefully. They all have meanings. And so it taken us a while to settle on the form of words that was generally the backbenchers were happy with. They were circulated to backbenchers, so they had seen them beforehand. And yeah, I take on board Mr. Crane's comments. The situation is hideously complicated. It's nuanced. It's got history behind it. It goes back decades that we can't even start to address or unpick. So I think I'm happy that the motion focuses on the here and now, and it focuses on the emergency and the humanitarian need that is currently in the region.
And this in no way, I don't know, you tell me, does this actually paint Tynwald in a pro-Palestine, anti-Israel light, which undoubtedly some people may choose to view it in that way?
No, I definitely don't think that's the case. We have roundly condemned the attacks by Hamas on Israel and the taking of hostages. We've called for the hostages to be released. Certainly what has then transpired are attacks by Israel trying to seek out the Hamas terrorists and trying to identify them and to capture them within Gaza, and the unfortunate problem of having something that's about the size of the Isle of Man but with 2.3 million people living on it is there pretty much is nowhere to hide from that action. And so I don't think that this is taking sides in the dispute at all. I absolutely condemn the actions of both sides that have led to loss of life of innocent civilians and non-combatants, because they've been dragged into it because there is nowhere else for them to be. There is nowhere else for them to go. And I think it's my heart breaks for everyone that's involved in the situation, because it is just tragic.
There are also critics who would argue that international law and the enforcement of international law should be left to the big players in the world, and tiny little Isle of Man and our voice is irrelevant in such matters. How would you respond to that?
Our voice is small on the international stage, but I think the fact that even the Chief Minister has discussed the motion with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in Westminster means that we've actually put forward our opinions to them, which I'm not sure had happened prior to that. And so that's right, that's where our representation comes. But I think the other aspect of speaking out today is to actually say to those, especially when we've seen demonstrations outside Tynwald and I've had numerous correspondence, it's to say to those people, yes, your views are valid, and yes, we do hear your concerns, and we stand with you. We can't do much, we admit that, but we need to do what little we can.
Was Onken MHK Julie Edger's question on greater fiscal responsibility a little mischievous?
I described your question as a little bit cheeky, your first starred question, but maybe mischievous is the one. And this is the question, basically, on what's being done in relation to greater financial responsibility across government.
Yes, and it wasn't mischievous. I think it's the Chief Minister stated it publicly, that he was going to ensure greater fiscal responsibility and to really reset finances, which I found quite alarming, to be honest, because we shouldn't be resetting any finances. We have financial regulations and they should be followed and adhered to.
And I suppose the reason I've suggested it was maybe mischievous is because I mean, this is blindingly obvious stuff. I mean, it's quite, well, I don't know, maybe you may feel the same as a former minister myself, to suggest that in some way we need to get back to financial responsibility is quite a shocking admission.
It is, but you've seen what happened when I tried to be fiscally responsible. I was fiscally responsible for the Department of Education, Sport and Culture when I was minister with regards to the Southern Swimming Pool. And we've seen what happened there. Major U-turn. I wasn't even involved in any of that decision-making process. So where did that money come from? And that's my point with fiscal responsibility. You can't just suddenly find a pot of money when a tough decision has to be made. You have to continue with the tough decision. It was made by the Council of Ministers, and we should continue with them. We should not be bound to pressure. Although, you know, I'm happy for the pool to remain open as long as the pool can afford to stay open with the financial plan that the Speaker and the Southern members have managed to achieve. I'm happy for that, but fiscally responsible is not doing U-turns. It's continuing with the major investment that was proposed with a new swimming pool in the south. And because I'd witnessed that so closely as to how it can happen, I don't feel we have got that fiscal accountability for the people of the island.
So effectively, what you seem to be saying there is that Council of Ministers, did they support or endorse your decision in relation to the Southern Pool?
Yes, I went from the message I was delivering to the Southern Pool was from the Council of Ministers. It was a recommendation, and that was due to be debated in Tynwald. And, of course, it never got to Tynwald, so the democratic process was interfered with.
So in that case, what appears to be the case anyway, anyone who's got any problems with government financing, all they need to do is kick off a bit and get their MHKs involved, and U-turns will follow. Is that pretty much what you think has happened in this case?
Well, that is clear. That's what's happened in this case, because the Department of Education was told there was no more money. Funding had been taken away for any energy costs for that year by Treasury, and the department didn't have that funding. And then it was agreed that that was the right way forward, because we were building a new school as part of the major project. But fiscal responsibility throughout government, and, you know, we've seen the major issues with Manx Care, and it came up quite a few times in the debate yesterday. It's over £100 million. I know that you raised that on Sunday with the Chief Executive Officer. Over £100 million in a short space of time. And most people that contact say services are not as good as they used to be. So fiscal responsibility is establishing where that money is going, where it's being spent, and making sure we are getting good value for money. And people held to account if they cannot keep within their budgets. I worked in the system for 38 years. If I'd have overspent a penny, I'm sure my head would have rolled. That was the system we were in. And financial responsibility for the island is the key, most important thing that any government should be considering.
The Chief Minister obviously answered your questions. You know, he has stated very publicly that this is a big deal now for council ministers to get these things right. Are you reassured by any of the answers he gave?
It was interesting to see that they've now decided to set up a different reporting regime, and there will be reports to the Council of Ministers. They didn't say the quarterly reports would come to Tynwald. They said they would produce quarterly reports. I suppose that's a step forward. However, the most important thing is keeping an eye on that bottom line on the 1st of April and how that ends up on the 31st of March the following year. And that was what I was interested in. How is the Chief Minister going to ensure that? He's saying he's got committees doing this and he's got people doing that, and it'll come to the Council of Ministers. We know the process, Phil. It takes, a good few weeks, 8 weeks to get anything into the Council of Ministers, and I'm not sure that's right. And I suppose, ultimately, any minister is responsible for their department. I know he commented about the Department of Education being overspent. That was purely salaries, and everybody knows that since the changes in the budget process, I think possibly was, it might have been before the current Chief Minister's time as Treasury Minister, but changing it so that they were putting caps on budgets and not personnel control mechanisms has certainly seen massive inflationary costs, I believe, to the people of the island.
The other things that you were very passionate about in Tynwald this week were items 5 and 6 on the order paper. This was the review into government's appeal in relation to the Dr. Ranson affair, as well as the report into the handling of COVID. You were heckled quite a lot by some of the ministers.
Yeah, absolutely appalling. It's interesting that we're discussing member standards today, isn't it? I find it, to try and stifle a member who's got freedom to speech in our chamber, I found the behaviour quite alarming. Certainly, and the most alarming came from an MLC who's unelected and not there to represent the people I am. And I won't be stifled. Whistleblowers should never be stifled. I will speak out for whistleblowers and I'll never be stifled on that topic. I do still believe that's why I lost my job, because I said I wanted to raise concerns about these reports. And however, I'll continue to speak up, because wrongdoers need to be held to account and whistleblowers need to be listened to. They might not always be right, but they have to be listened to in a proper process and procedure in for them. Currently got legislation going through that was actually going to hinder whistleblowers. It's currently with Legislative Council, and I think it was Clause 8, and that would have completely hindered a whistleblower in any process. And, you know, I'm seeing ways of trying to stop people speaking out, and we should have a public sector where all people are confident they are not in fear of losing their jobs if they speak out. And if the wrongdoing is proved, government should be holding that to account under the current policies.
And that bill that you refer to, which bill was that?
It's the Employment Act that's going through.
Are you content with the conclusions of the two reports, or do you feel that a different conclusion should have been reached?
Oh, well, I didn't vote for the Council of Ministers' quick response. It was a quick response. And I actually feel that have they learned any lessons? I don't feel they have, because if you look at the responsibilities throughout response to the recommendations, they're putting it back to the very departments that were involved in the first place. And I feel that it should have been very similar to other jurisdictions, and I'm not in favour of that always, but I think on this occasion we should be leading on that and ensuring that we've got a central place for emergency planning, emergency processes, and that particularly the Council of Ministers have to be there in the middle making the decisions with the officers for the people of the island. And I didn't see that in the recommendations.
One of the perhaps quite shocking things that David Ashford said in his motion relating to a register of business of ministerial decisions was that he had taken a decision when he was health minister, and only for the fact that one of his members was also a member of the education department would it have been discovered that a conflicting decision had been taken by the then education department. Do you think government gets this? I mean, because there's a move against the idea of a single legal entity in government, but to many people listening to this programme, they'd be thinking, well, for goodness sakes, do ministers not talk to each other?
I think the biggest issues we've got is governance. I think lack of knowledge, understanding of policy, process, good governance, conflicts. I see people completely in a conflicted situation carrying on. And I just find that quite alarming for, you know, you should know when you're conflicted in anything. But with regards to, I was quite surprised hearing that with regards to the mover of the motion on ministers' decisions outside of, you know, the normal meeting process. Certainly, if there was anything like that in when I was in my responsibility, I would have shared that. It was always on the following meeting, and we always met weekly anyway. It would only be a very urgent situation that you should be doing a ministerial decision on, and I don't think that's the case. I think there's sometimes they're getting made and trying, and I don't know, circumventing going to the full meeting, but they should always be reported at the following meeting. Conflicts, good governance need to be understood.
Laurie Hooper answered a question on access to NHS dentistry. How big a problem is that?
So I think the whole structure of NHS dentistry has been a problem here for a while, just like it is in the UK, and I think we're not immune from that. And ultimately, I think whilst we have the current structure of NHS dentistry on the island, it's always going to be a problem. Quite frankly, I think what we're looking at is the structure itself probably needs to change, because the only other alternative is to just try and buy more units really from private dentists, and that's fine if they have capacity and if they can recruit dentists, but there's a lot of ifs there and whether or not they can deliver on those. Whereas I think what we're going to need to look at is there a better way of delivering dentistry for people on the NHS on the island, and whether that is through a review of the contractual setup, for example. So I know Manx Care are working on that with the dentists and with the dental association on the island, but it is fair to say it is a problem that's been around for a while. It doesn't have a quick fix, I think, and it is something that we are prioritising this year through the mandate as well, trying to focus on dentistry and other primary care services, not to the exclusion of all else, but ultimately we're seeing that the outside of Nobles part of the health service, so mental health, dentistry, primary care, social care, they're the areas that need a bit more focus and attention, and that's really the focus of this year's mandate.
What one of the things that perhaps people find frustrating is that, you know, various problems were described at the election. You know, housing was one that was the housing crisis was on everyone's lips, on all the manifestos. Whilst dentistry perhaps wasn't quite as high on the list of priorities, it was up there, particularly for people who don't have dentists. Is there any hope that there'll be progress made on this?
Yes, so like I say, this year it is a focus of us in the department and of Manx Care. It's very much high on the priority list for the next 12 months. So I am hoping that we'll start seeing some movement this year.
Three different departments seem to be involved with this. This was the extra capital funding required in relation to the building of the care home. £2.333 million extra was going to be required for this. In a way, it was a good news story, but I think many people listening might think, how on earth can you manage a project with three separate areas of government responsible for different elements of what goes on?
Yeah, the capital programme is complicated, I think, and the capital process we have to follow. So it's Treasury's job to keep one handle on the total budget, make sure they've got overall oversight. It's the project management unit who actually run the projects and deal with the day-to-day bills. And then obviously the department, or in this case Manx Care, would be the end client. So we're the end user. We're the one saying what we need the rooms to look like and what the design needs to compass and all that kind of stuff. So it can be a bit difficult at times, I think, to get everyone on the same page. But I think you're right in describing this as a reason good news story, in that if you look at the work the PMU have done, there were changes needed to the design towards the end, things to deal with, different wash basins, things around infection control procedures that needed to be put in place. But the additional costs for all those things were offset by savings that PMU managed to find elsewhere inside the budget. The overspend really came from the fact that the project started. I mean, the budget, I think, was originally agreed back in 2017. It would have been, I think it was 11 point something million back then. There were planning appeals, so that actually didn't get on site then until 2020, and then COVID hit with the lockdown. So when you've got a budget that was approved before tender, then the tender hits, then the COVID hits, and then actually you've seen the prices of materials and the construction sector almost heat up quite a lot then as a result of things like Brexit and the war in Ukraine. You're looking at all these things happening over a really long time scale, and now coming back towards the end of it and saying, well, obviously that was going to have an impact. You can't predict those things. So I wouldn't have expected at the outset for the Treasury to have a contingency built into the scheme for £2 million on what turned out to be a £14 million build. That would be a significant contingency to hold. So ultimately, I think what we're seeing, and we've seen it with a couple of projects, I think, where the original proposal, the original budget has been sort of blown out of out of the water almost by these bigger international events that we've got no control over. And that's really what's been a result of the cost. I mean, I think I said it was 72 weeks delayed as a result of all of these things. And inevitably, when a project takes longer, it costs more. When material prices go up, if the project is still running, obviously you're still exposed to all those risks as the project continues. So it's on the one hand, it's disappointing that we have to come back and ask for additional money, but actually on the flip side, all of the things that were within the control of the PMU of government seem to have been handled pretty well by all accounts. It's the bits that were outside of our control that ultimately we have no choice but to say, well, if you want this built, it needs to be built, and ultimately we have to pay people to do that. I mean, I'm advised that a lot of the work and a lot of the money actually would have been to local Manx contractors and Manx firms anyway, because that's the nature of the way the contract was structured. So most of it goes back into the economy and into the system and ends up coming back out the other side. So in the grand scheme of things, you know, 2.3 million, it feels like a lot of money, but when you look at what you're getting for the money and the time scale this project's been going over, ultimately I think everyone involved has done a pretty good job.
Finally, Arbury, Castletown and Maloo MHK Jason Moorhouse persuaded his Tynwald colleagues of a need for fairer access to the internet.
It appeared from the motion that you're concerned that some of your constituents, island residents generally, are struggling to afford now to pay for internet access.
Yeah, it's a growing problem. It's something that really first became an issue during the first lockdown, when people realised they were stuck at home and they needed to access their families and the local community and whatever it may be. And since I've been actually looking at a way forward that will provide some level of basic low-cost internet service for anyone on the island, and today we've possibly had a breakthrough.
And for listeners who weren't glued to their radio sets listening to Tynwald, what actually happened in terms of the debate?
It was very one-sided. It was focusing on the provision in libraries, the way in which these people could access the internet, rather than a new product being made available in the home at a low cost that people would have the choice to access. So when it actually came to the summing up, I thought it was a case of no chance at all. So I just tried to focus on the core aspects, that this is a service that is available in the wholesale market, it's available in the UK, and it's just a matter of consultation taking place with the providers, looking at the wider community, and if it could be made available, it can simply be switched on. And it's going to be one additional thing for Cura to do, but it's part of what they're doing already, so it's nothing radically different.
So effectively, Cura are asked to do what?
Well, basically, Cura are looking at telecoms, and they will have a consultation over the coming months in terms of what can be offered in terms of basic service for use on the Isle of Man, because at the moment there's no offering, and Tynwald's given them the instruction to go off and do that. Now, depending on how generous those telecom providers are and what they can actually provide for a low cost, we'll see what is actually available in the coming months, and that will then have a price assigned to it based on the cost to the telecoms providers. No one should lose out on this situation. And then that should go into the marketplace. And hopefully, this time next year, people will have that additional option. So in addition to the mid-range offering and the premier range offering, there's going to be a basic offering of internet access.
Inevitably, though, because the providers are businesses, the private sector companies that need to make a profit, if there is a basic offering which is cheaper than the current basic offering, someone's going to end up paying for it, and that'll probably be the mid to high range users.
Well, in terms of the cost of the service, it's been quite clear throughout the motion that at the point when this comes in, it's going to be paid for in terms of the cost of making it available. So there's going to be no additional cost to any other users. The last part of the motion does make reference to going forward and saying going forward, there needs to be a consideration of a social tariff, but that is for going forward. In the immediate future, the emphasis on providing a service that is comparable with services across and will provide a low cost access to the internet for anyone on the island who wants that basic access. It's not going to be a great offering in terms of what is available. You know, you're not going to be able to watch your Netflix and whatever, but you're going to get your key information from Manx Radio, email your doctor, and send messages to your family.
Have you had conversations with internet providers? And if so, what were their comments?
My discussions really have focused on Cura and the constituents in terms of the reassurance from Cura that the package is available. I thought that was enough. I thought if I went into the telecommunications companies, I was perhaps starting an argument, and in terms of what I want to do was say there is clarity in terms of there's a service that can be made available, let's make it available.
Jason Moorhouse there, pulling the curtain down on our roundup of this month's lively Tynwald sitting. Are you surprised that he didn't contact the internet providers to discuss his concerns? And what do you think of the other matters? Are you pleased that government is finally taking greater fiscal responsibility? Do you think government is doing enough to tackle housing and dentistry waiting lists? Do we need a central register of ministerial decisions? And should Tynwald be having opinions on important international matters such as the conflict in Gaza? There's certainly plenty to ponder as you digest your Yorkshire pud. Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com, and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. For now though, I'm Phil Gorn, Goramayos and Geisha Crum. Thanks for listening.